Hi, I'm Steve Clemens, and I have a question. After more than 1 million deaths attributed to the coronavirus, what did America get wrong in its response? And is it going to get any better? Let's get to the bottom line. America's response to the COVID-19 pandemic has always been a work in progress. In the early days, very few people knew what the virus was or what the world was going to do about it. Different countries tried to fight COVID in different ways, shutting borders and locking down their citizens as much as possible. This show did its first expose on the potential consequences of a deadly pandemic on February 11, 2020, even before it had been officially termed a pandemic. But many simply did not take the threat seriously at that time. As time marches on and vaccines are becoming more widespread, people are learning to live side by side with the virus, even though we're obviously not out of the woods. Now we're seeing people who already got the virus get reinfected, in some cases reinfected again. We still don't know what all the effects of long COVID are, and the virus keeps mutating into new variants. Today we're talking with a leading physician who had a front row seat to all the politics, the science, and the media wars that were going on inside the White House and around it when the pandemic broke out more than 2 years ago. Dr. Deborah Birx was the White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator during the Trump administration, and she's just come out with a book on her time there, Silent Invasion, the untold story of the Trump administration, COVID-19, and preventing the next pandemic before it's too late. Dr. Birx, thank you so much for joining us today. And I guess, you know, the obvious question is, when you kind of look at the pandemic came, and I was, you know, we were talking about that on February 2020, early before a lot of folks had even begun to register this might be serious. How did we get so much wrong?
Well, you know, I think most of our people who are working in public health in the United States haven't worked globally. And we've been battling pandemics, HIV, TB, malaria, Zika, Ebola around the world for decades, and successfully so. So we had those lessons learned. So I'm, it's interesting that
so the international system had it.
Well, because we knew, we knew that it starts with community and it starts with data and it starts working with people from day one. And so I think where the U.S. really thought that they could contain the virus, sometimes highly industrial, high-income countries think that they can conquer infectious diseases. But we've learned when you work around the globe that that wealth does not determine your ability of being infected or not infected.
Well, I guess I'm really interested in the next pandemic or the next big thing that comes. And in my view, just reading and listening to you, you believe that will happen.
Yes. Well, I believe that if you want to be ready for the next pandemic, you figure out this one. And if we can get this one under control, we will be ready for the next one. And it's not just the public health infrastructure. It is setting up two parallel systems. And so the information that we need is in the clinical and the laboratory system of the United States. And so we don't need another public health system. We need to learn how to work successfully every day with the private sector that's getting the information. So the information is there, and the information was always there, but we weren't collecting it systematically and anonymized so that no one could tell who was who, like we do all around the world. So, I mean, if we had approached HIV and TB like the U.S. approached COVID in those early days, we would have failed miserably. And we learned that you create the data so you know where the virus is, where it's going, and what needs to be done.
So let's see what Donald Trump shared with us on February 24th. The coronavirus is very much under control in the USA. We're in contact with everyone and all relevant countries, CDC and World Health have been working hard and very smart. Stock market starting to look very good to me. I find this fascinating at the time because I was freaking out that this was spreading, the silent spread, that it was probably already here in droves.
Correct.
Donald Trump links it to the stock market. So what was going on there?
Starting in January, like you, I'm seeing this. I call the National Security Council, the Africa Bureau, and say, this is an emergency. I need all the African diplomats coming into the White House, and we need to talk to them about what's coming. And so we're holding a meeting the end of January with all the African diplomats so that they'll cable to their countries and so that they'll say those resources, the laboratory infrastructure, everything that we built to combat HIV, TB, and malaria, you can use the people, the labs, the facilities you can use to combat COVID and get ready. So I'm taking this very seriously, and the U.S. is talking about containment, because just like you, I knew it was everywhere because I could see that it was spreading silently. You don't end up with that many people in the hospital in Wuhan if there's not incredible community spread. And the only way you have that level of community spread without awareness is when most of it is happening in people that have such mild disease that they don't believe that they're infected.
You know, Dr. Birx, I'm going to share something with our audience about you that many may not know. For 29 years, you were in the Army. You were an Army colonel.
Correct.
You helped run PEPFAR, and PEPFAR, which, of course, was a rather remarkably successful interdiction with HIV/AIDS in Africa, in the developing part of the world. And I don't know how to put this, and I may put it, you know, inelegantly. There are a lot of kind of big-headed guys that are running, you know, governments, militaries, and you also work with a lot of that kind of person in the White House, the Trump White House. So I'd just be interesting to reflect on your time working with, you know, narcissistic, self-absorbed bosses, both in the White House, but also out in Africa and in the military. You were one of the few women of your stature in public health. Tell us about that journey.
Well, you find a way to make it work. And the reason you do that is because lives are at stake. And so, you know, so many people say, well, why didn't you do this? Or why didn't you do that? Or why didn't you leave? As long as you're making progress, even if it's on scene, but you can see it, and you know that you're making a difference every day. And that's the way I've always approached everything I've done. I mean, in the military, it was the same way. HIV was very stigmatizing. And so to be in the military in the 80s, working for commanders of the hospital, which were 2- and 3-star general, who would look me in the eye and say, I don't want AIDS cases here because I don't want to be known as the AIDS hospital. This is Walter Reed in the 80s. And I said,
I mean, with all due respect, it kind of sounds like President Trump saying, don't test anymore. We don't want to find any more people with tests.
So it's very similar. But as opposed to President Trump, who was saying that and then giving me $3, $6, $7 billion to expand testing around the United States and calling in the private sector and asking them to make all the tests that we need, he was saying one thing and we were able to do something very different. And I think that's where you continue to work. On scene, on heard, but making a big difference day after day. And that's how I've had to work around the globe. There are so many of these pandemics are political. And so many of them are, so many infectious diseases are stigmatizing. And a lot of people go to the corners and you don't want to talk about it. And when you can talk to people frankly about what's actually happening and show them the data, that's when you get movement and policy changes. And even though the president, after about early April, was not really looking at my data anymore, the vice president and the task force was. And more critically, the private sector was using that data to ensure that we get the supplies to the people who need it. And that was what was important to me. When you work, we were essentially a resource-limited setting in that time. I mean, we didn't have PPE. We didn't have treatments. Treatments were very limited. And when you have limited resources, like I've had for decades in sub-Saharan Africa,
you just do what you need to do to save lives.
Was
Vice President Pence a hero in this? Was he a villain? You know, Alex Azar, Peter Navarro, who's been in the news a lot lately. You know, when you look at the circle of people there, and, you know, Vice President Pence was given, at least for a time, you know, some latitude to deal with this. Did you find pockets of support for what you felt like you really needed to do to save lives? And I have to say, save lives, despite the fact that we're talking about this because 1 million Americans have died. And that's something we shouldn't be at all acquiescing to or happy with.
Yeah, I think you describe it perfectly. I know people would like to have everybody into a black and white, to have either victims or villains. And it wasn't like that. And that's why I thought it was important to write the book, because I wanted people to understand what went right and what went wrong. Because if you don't, you're managing correcting the wrong things.
Right.
And I think part of that is today we haven't been transparent enough about what's working and what's not working. And that has led us to just really confusing communications to the American people and not real-time common sense solutions that they can apply to protect themselves and their family. And that's really the key and the most important thing to me, is there are solutions out there for everything that we're experiencing. And many of the countries have gotten those solutions to the public in a very clear, transparent way. And we still suffer in this United States from not being able to get that clarity into every community.
When I look at attitudes about President Biden's response to coronavirus, we see about 49% of Americans approve, 43% disapprove. You know, it's very partisan, the view. 81% of Democrats are supportive of him, 42% of independents, which is not a great number, and 19% of Republicans. I guess perhaps this is an unfair question because you're a public health, you're a doctor and you're out there running systems, but you must have a sense of the ability of the nation to absorb science and absorb guidance. How did this become, it's really because independents are different too. Independents, Republicans, and Democrats, three different countries.
We let it do that. And I think we're letting it do that still today. And that is what I find so discouraging, because we should be treating every hospitalization and every death as a programmatic failure and holding ourselves accountable. That is the way you change pandemics. That's what I did with HIV. That's what I did with TB. And we have 90% less new cases of HIV in many countries of sub-Saharan Africa. But you have to treat every new infection as a failure. And I think in this country, we're still doing the tyranny of averages. We're still making states or counties red and blue. When you put up data and you put it up as a how people voted, you further push people into the corners. And I have found that where I've worked, if you go and talk to people honestly with clear data and the evidence to make decisions, they will make the right decisions. But you have to use local peer educators like we learned with HIV. You can't go in there and say, I said that from the White House microphone. That doesn't work. Get on the ground, see what's happening, talk to communities, find out what their barriers to access are. Why aren't we talking about right now that it's not, people look at healthcare and they think it's all the same. I can tell you healthcare in New York City area is very different than healthcare in Mississippi. And people have been dying at a higher rate in our rural counties for decades, COVID has uncovered that. But this isn't because they voted Republican or they voted Democrat. It's because they don't have access to the same level of health care.
How do we elevate that commitment to the uncovered, unconnected American and prioritize that? Because I think you're one of the few people I've read who gets the fact that their health is our health. And I think that's true internationally, too, that our health of the underdeveloped nation that does not have the resources we do, guess what? What happens there may come and impact our health here. How do we change the vector? Because I got to tell you, almost no one in this town in Washington, D.C. walks around with that template.
First, you have to shed a bright light onto the issue like you are doing. And that is absolutely critical. And that's our job, is to really shine that bright light and say it's not so simple. When I came back, I found a country with less data and less communication than I had in sub-Saharan Africa.
The United States of America.
I found tribal nations that were less for healthcare access than what I had built for communities in Africa. And I felt incredibly guilty. And so, my passion and why I have so many sections on that in the book is we know what to do. We know what to do, but we have to recognize that it's a problem. I think for decades, we believed if we built stronger urban areas, then we would elevate healthcare everywhere. And we neglected all the rural areas. Most people in rural areas believe their doctor is the Walmart eye doctor and the ER that is 2 hours away. So if you look at how distant people are from, let's use level one trauma as a surrogate. Because in order to become a level one trauma, you have to have surgeons and you have to have advanced and sophisticated medical care. So let's use that as an indicator. There are 22 level one trauma centers within the New York metro area. is one in Mississippi.
In the whole state?
In the whole state.
Wow.
And so when you look at who has health care within 30 minutes, you'll start to see that most of the red counties do not. Do not. And we did nothing about it. We built up the urban centers and created this sense that there would be a hub and a spoke. But the people who are living at the end of the spokes know that they don't have the same access, and they're angry about it. And that has further disenfranchised them because people have not been there. I loved it when I watched TV and they said, well, talk to your primary doctor about COVID vaccines. Map where there are primary doctors and how other people can access them again. And I think you'll find that most of the red counties don't have access to primary care doctors, haven't for decades. So in the end, that's why their diabetes is more out of control, their hypertension, their obesity, all those factors that put them at a greater risk. All of our tribal nations that have not had adequate preventive care for decades, COVID has uncovered that.
Did you feel like you were in a kind of a really bad Netflix soap opera sometimes? I mean, I think, you know, sometimes when you see some of these episodes, it would come up. Like the whole, I mean, one of the ones that I followed a lot was the hydroxychloroquine obsession, which proved to be this very, very weird sideshow, but with staggering numbers of people who believed in it, and it, you know, created misinformation. Or, you know, we know, and you've often talked about it, about the day where you're in the room and you're on camera, you know, chlorine and disinfectant and what President Trump was willing to say. And I know, and I've read what you've said, that it was important for you to be in the room to try to fix these problems as and not just abandon ship. And then when they tried to shut you down, you went to talk to governors and go out to states and tried to do this. I guess my question is, what is your counsel to people who are sitting at other tables in their kitchens, or they're sitting in other policy planning discussions, and the next chlorine disinfectant comments come, or the next, you know, hydroxychloroquine type fad comes up? How do responsible people remain engaged with nuttiness?
Well, it's, you know, I guess I don't like to classify it as nuttiness, because in the HIV/AIDS pandemic, when we had nothing, people were looking for cures and treatment with all kinds of products. So I lived that, and I lived that desperation. Now, if you're in a rural area where there is no remdesivir, where there is no Paxlovid, where there are no adequate testing, what are you going to do? You're going to grab onto something that you can get your hands on. Because when you have nothing and access to nothing, you look for those miracles and you look for that hope and you hold on to anything that you can get access to. Our mistake, and our mistake continues to be, I mean, we've lost 180,000 Americans since January of 2022. 180,000 Americans just in the last 5.5 months. Why aren't we getting tests to the people we know who need it the most with a hotline that says, call this, show them your test, get your telemedicine. If you don't have a smartphone, call them. They'll believe you. They'll send you Paxlovid in the mail. It will come to your address. That is the way you get services to people that live in far distant and rural areas. And we have that information, and we're not using it. So I just feel like we have the tools. We have the common sense answers. We're not using peer educators. We're not getting information through people that they trust. We're not in the churches. We're not in the tribal nations every day. We're not setting up solutions that can work for every single American. Yes, if you live in the Washington area,
despite
the New York area, the LA area, you can.
Despite our experience here, we are not doing this.
Exactly.
Let me just ask you, you know, finally, the Deborah Birx as scientist, because I've read that you have looked at the data, particularly out of Africa. You see these 4 and 6 month cycles that come on. And in a way, I want to ask you, do we need to be scared straight in the sense that even when I introduced this show, I said something I'm not completely comfortable with, that we're learning to live with the virus. And I'm not sure that's the right attitude or posture we should have. And I guess my fear is that, talking to a lot of scientists, I know that variants can come in different forms, and they don't always become more benign. They can become something more deadly. I've been hearing about potential variants that are vaccine resistant. And so can you share, give us a snapshot, frankly, of why we should not be comfortable with the fact of potentially living with the virus? What is out there that we need to really arm ourselves against? Because we are sort of shrugging our shoulders about a million people dead. I mean, it could be a very different number. Tell us how we need to change our frame.
Well, we have the tools to live with the virus. But I think the key phrase that you just said is live. What is our plan so every American can live? Not just those 45 or 25-year-olds, but the 65-year-olds, the 85-year-old. How are they going to live and survive despite COVID? And there is a pathway to do that, but we're still not on that road. Other countries have gotten on that road. And so if you look at Delta and Omicron in the UK, their death rates were almost half what ours were. When we were equal all through 2020. In 2021, they had half. The reason they had half is they communicated to the public successfully. They told them that vaccines were not the 100% answer. In this country, we said, throw off your mask. A vaccine's going to keep you from getting infected. We never had that evidence. When you say you're following the data and the science, you have to look at the data and the science. And once you saw those periodic surges in South Africa, it was clear that natural infection did not lead to long-term protection, like measles, mumps, and rubella, and therefore the vaccine was not going to lead to long-term protection from infection. So now we have a lot more people with mild and asymptomatic disease passing it on to their sick aunts, their grandparents, and those individuals are dying. So the UK started testing at four times our rate. But not only four times the rate, they told the people the reason to test. You test before you go and visit grandma because you could be silently infected. And people did it. And so that's what is always discouraging to me. No matter where I've worked, if you show people the evidence, the graphs, the data, everyone can understand it. It's not, it's your job as a public health official to make sure that people get what you're talking about and spend enough time answering their questions so that they get it. And it's our job then to make sure that they not only get it, they have the tools to survive. And so we're not putting enough emphasis on communication down at the county and the local level with peer educators. And we're not putting enough tools into those counties so everyone can survive. If we do that, just like we did with HIV and TB, we can have a different outcome. But we can't just say test and treat and everything's going to be better. And then when it isn't, yes, we've gotten through a low swell. We had one last year with Alpha variant. Variants are predictable, swells are predictable, surges are predictable.
Well, I want to thank you for that. Deborah Birx, former White House Coronavirus Task Force Coordinator during the Trump administration and author of, and you should read it, Silent Invasion. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
So what's the bottom line? Former President Donald Trump was laser focused on his election prospects and wanted to stay on message. The virus is under control. No need to panic. He thought, in my view, incorrectly, that leveling with the American public would undermine the economy and cost him political support. Science had to take a back seat with him. President Joe Biden doesn't sugarcoat the reality of the situation as much, but he was also unprepared for the waves of coronavirus that infected millions and killed hundreds of thousands under his watch. And his administration's public guidance on masks and on vaccines and on testing, contact tracing, has also been erratic. This pandemic has exposed America's inequality and political divisions, and now the United States has the sad distinction of being number one in the world in known coronavirus deaths. My guest says we have to take our blinders off and make sure we are better prepared next time. Because in my view, there will be a next time. And that's the bottom line.